I'm not crazy about the arrangements.
You're not?
Definitely not. I'm paying the rent. I will make it a rules. I like to take showers every morning, and I don't like the panties drying on the rod. I like to cook, so I will use the kitchen whenever I damn well please. And I am very particular about my condiments, so keep your salt and pepper to yourself. Plus, I play the guitar in the middle of the night whenever I cannot sleep, and I meditate every morning, complete with chanting and burning incense, so if you've got to walk around, I'd appreciate a little tiptoeing. Also, I sleep in the nude. A buffalo. Winter and summer, rain or snow, with the windows open. And because I may have to go to the potty or to the fridge in the middle of the night, and because I don't want to put on jammies, which I do not own in the first place, unless you're looking for a quick thrill or your daughter in advanced education, I would keep my door closed. Them's my rules and regulations. How does that grab you?
This is Cameron Meyer of the Orlando Weekly and MeyerMovies.com. And that is, of course, Richard Dreyfuss in Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl from 1977. Directed by Herbert Ross and co-starring Marsha Mason. That fair use clip is copyright MGM and United Artists. The Goodbye Girl is the film that won Dreyfuss the Oscar for Best Actor, and it's also the movie that the Florida Film Festival will be screening this Friday, April 19th, at the Enzian Theater in Maitland, Florida. And in attendance for the screening will be none other than Richard Dreyfuss, with whom I recently had the privilege of speaking.
Hi, is this Mr. Dreyfuss?
This is Mr. Dreyfuss, yes.
This is Cameron Meyer. It's great to talk to you.
Mr. Meyer, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day to chat with me.
It's the highlight of my life.
Oh, well, it's the highlight of my life. It's something I've been waiting for a very long time. So let me just...
I know when to deliver.
Let me just jump right in and ask you about The Goodbye Girl, because that's the movie that you'll be screening at the Florida Film Festival on Friday. It's, of course, the movie that you won the Oscar for. What are your thoughts and feelings about the film some 40 years later?
If I'm not going to be struck by lightning for admiring myself and praising my project, I would say that... If there was an appropriate film that showed me at my best, that's it. And it actually didn't occur to me until within the last year or two that I had never really done a part since then like that one, which was an all-out ballsy comedy. And it wasn't, it's not definable as a romantic comedy. It's just a funny performance. And yes, it is romantic. But I never had an experience like it before or since. And I used to say that I could play Elliot Garfield until I retired with a Swiss watch 50 years later, because Neil Simon somehow heard in me that character, and I, from the first moment I read that script, it was a miracle, because he heard me, and he heard my rhythm, and it was fantastic.
Well, it's a wonderful film.
Not to say anything about the fact that it was written by Neil, and it was played by Marsha and Quinn, and directed by Herb Ross.
Yes.
All of whom, you just add water, and what comes out is a graceful, creative miracle.
I couldn't agree more. It's a wonderful film, and I haven't seen it in about 25 years, and I'm looking so forward to seeing it again with you on Friday. It sounds like you really pulled from your own past as a theater actor for inspiration for this part, or are there other aspects of the character that you just identified with immediately?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I don't know how other actors answer questions like this, because I've never been able to say anything about my process or how I come to a role or how I don't. I do know that I didn't have to be a theater actor to play that role. I knew that I had to be me, and me squared, in a sense.
Yes.
And I remember when I first met Paul Mazursky, he had asked me to do a film called Next Stop Greenwich Village. And I argued with him because it was the story of a young American actor in the early 50s, and there was no mention of Marlon Brando. And I kept telling him, I found it unbelievable that he would not, that they wouldn't talk about it, to the extent that I just withdrew from the film. And now Paul and I went on to make a lot of movies together, and we became intensely close friends. But that was the first time. I didn't have to, when Goodbye Girl came up, have to draw upon a specific thing. It was my whole life. It was my romantic life, my professional perspective. It was the willingness to just jump in and be. Yes. And he found all of it. I don't know how he did it.
Well, it shows. It's just an amazing performance. And even more amazing, I think, is the fact that that very same year, 1977, you had another performance that I think just as easily could have gotten you a nomination or a win for Best Actor. And that's, of course, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So a very, very different type of character, but just a wonderful film. It's the second of three films you made with Steven Spielberg. So I guess my question is, you know, by the time you're 30, you've got this amazing resume. You've got American Graffiti, you've got Jaws, you've got Goodbye Girl and Close Encounters, and you've won the Oscar. Was it difficult to process that amount of success at such a young age, or
yes,
you have to look back on it from you know, years down the road? Did it take a long time to process that amount of success that you achieved so young?
Well, it took me about 10 years to understand why I felt so uncomfortable at the end of the evening when I got the Oscar. I didn't know why, because I knew, I really did know I was going to win. I was not surprised at the win, and I was thrilled and happy. But at the end of the evening, I was not at ease. And it took me years and years to realize the oldest cliche, which is, you know, sometimes things happen too soon.
Yes.
And if you had asked me, let's say in the middle of the 80s, would you ever write an autobiography? My answer would have been, of course, but the name of the book would be called The Hunt. Because I knew that I was much more comfortable on the hunt than I was having already achieved something. And what happened that night was that from that moment on, there would be this assumption that I would be great or I would be something. And I didn't like that. I wanted to prove it. I was much more comfortable proving it. And if you want any, what they call a psychological gesture to prove this point, you can watch just about any film I've ever done, and you'll see this thing happen. You'll see some other actor say something to me, which is basically, oh, bullshit. And you'll see me with a slight smile nodding my head. Just a kind of nodding.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my way, unconsciously, of saying, I'll show you. Mm. And so you can see it. This is not a secret. You can see it in a lot of my work, and both before and after. But I hated the idea that someone would come to me and say, we want to give you this great role, and we know you're going to be great at it.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to work for it.
Right.
Yeah. Was there a sense that somehow it came too easy? Because, I mean, you worked your heart out for the 1970s, up to 1977.
I had actually been working since I was 12, and I had done 10 years of television.
That's right.
And I had made my way up the television rung until I was being offered pilots and such. But I hadn't done features until the middle 70s. And I was, without any way of explaining this, I was a television actor for 10 years. And then I started to do features, and I was 10 times better immediately than I had been for 10 years. And I could tell you stories after stories to illustrate that, but the fact was, when you look at my work on television and you look at my work in movies, it's just night and day. I just relaxed.
Is it because of the different type of process of feature filmmaking, very different from television?
No. I don't think of it as different at all. As a matter of fact, I think it had to do with maturity, and it had to do with a little bonding ceremony that I had with a camera once. When I was 16, 17 years old, I was doing some TV show. I don't remember which one. But I was uncomfortable. I was just not relaxed. I didn't create. Once the director said action, I was repeating what I had done in rehearsal. And I couldn't figure out why, because it didn't make sense that I would not be comfortable doing what I loved so much. And so, true story, I was staring at the camera while everyone else was doing something else. And I went up to the camera, and I leaned into the lens and I said very quietly, I want you to like me. Hmm. And I like you. And we're going to be together for a very long, long time. Hmm. And then, knowing that one never touches the lens of a camera, I just kissed the air in front of that lens and went back.
That's a wonderful story.
And I was never nervous again.
Sounds like you made sort of a peace with the camera, a peace with your craft and your art.
Well, you know, one of the things that happens when you make a movie, and I've objected to it from the first one to the last, it's that you work for 3 months, and only some people get formally introduced. So you spend 3 months talking and becoming friends with people whose name you don't know. And that's a phenomena of movie making. And so I've always said that everyone at the beginning of a film should wear one of those little things on their jacket that says, "Hi, my name is," and fill it in. Mm-hmm. So that you have a week to get to know people's names. Because you'll go 3, 4, 5 months, and I've done that, without knowing people's names who you're either drinking with or sleeping with or, you know, having fun with. So I never could convince the studio to pay for it. But that's when anyone ever asks me, what is it that you need? I say the same thing. I need a creative and relaxed atmosphere. And that's it. You give me that, and I will do my best. You give me that, and I will be a wonderful person to work with. You don't give me that, and all hell will break loose. Yeah. So I know what I need, and I think I know what everyone needs in that sense. I mean, there are some people who do work well with stress or with anger or darkness. I don't. I work well when everyone is, you know, we're going to the yellow brick road. everyone has to be a little happy.
Well, piggybacking off that, is there a particular movie or acting memory that you have where things just aligned perfectly? You've mentioned Goodbye Girl, but I didn't know if there's another movie that you've done that's one of your favorites, that just was such an enjoyable experience for you?
You know, the truth is that if I had to, I could probably conjure up two or three films that I didn't enjoy. But I'll never tell you which one.
Well, I won't press you for those.
But I loved passionately what I did for a living. And I was aware very, very quickly that I was blessed, that I got to do that which I loved. I was praised and paid, and I did it for 60 years. And what's wrong with that picture?
It's a wonderful picture.
Yeah, it is. And if I could bottle it, I'd sell it, and everyone should buy it. And I'm a very articulate person about things that I care about, except for the very process of why I'm an actor, why I chose this part, why there's a lot of stuff that is instinctive. And it's like looking at, when you look at a great athlete, you know, you can't say to a golfer, I'm going to tell my hands to do this and I'm going to tell my elbows to do that. You just trust that your body is going to do what you got to do. And it's true of basketball players. You know, there are certain, sometimes when you see a great basketball player and he's in midair, he's twisted to the left and headed downward, and somehow surrounded by all these other opponents, he manages to know the geometry and the calculus and the weight, and he can toss that ball from where he is in midair into the basket. Now, but who's the last part of his body that he told that to? None. He just, that's his wholeness. And I know of stories of actors, and I've been, there's a great story about Laurence Olivier doing Othello. And by the way, he was the last white actor ever to play Othello. And that is a disgrace to the art. That's just wrong. But in 1965, he was playing Othello. He lowered his voice an octave and a half. He played the character as if he was from the Caribbean. And one night, and I know a very good friend of mine was there, one night he was in the zone. In the same way that an athlete can be in the zone, Laurence Olivier was in the zone, and every actor in that show knew it. And so at the first opportunity they had, they were calling all their friends all over London, get your ass down to this theater, he's in the zone. And many actors piled into the side entrances and watched this man give a performance that was just ungodly. And at the end, he took his bow. He walked off the stage. He had the first dressing room off the stage. He went in, slammed the door, and they heard crashing and banging and breaking and glass and cursing, and they thought he'd lost his mind. And they started to pound on the door. Larry, Larry, what's the matter? Larry, you were great. You were brilliant. And the door got flung open, and there was Laurence Olivier with tears streaming down his blackened cheeks. And he said, I know I was brilliant. I don't know how I did it.
Oh,
and,
amazing.
And that's being in the zone, because when you're in the zone, you can't look too closely or it'll go away, and you can't ignore it or it'll go away. So you've got to do a dance in your brain. And I have had such experiences, and I know that it's like being in being one with everything, every living and unliving thing in the world. You're at one with the rhythm of your own heart and soul. You're at one with the rhythm of every actor on the stage. You're at one with the point you're trying to make, and you know it, and you can feel it. And I remember once when I was playing Iago in Central Park, there was one line I never got right. I never got it right. And then one night I did. And it was so obvious that every actor on the stage stopped for a second, looked over at me and went, pretty good. And I could never do it again. But
Richard, when you talk about being in the zone, is there another movie role that comes to mind? I mean, the one that comes to mind to me is Roy Neary in Close Encounters. How do you feel about that role?
If I had to ask myself, there are three that come to mind. One is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. One is Let It Ride. And one is, what's the first one I thought about?
Elliot?
Well, Elliot, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. But there was one other that...
Matt Hooper,
when I look at,
maybe?
When I look at... When I look at Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, I was asked to play this character, and I was the last actor that you would think would be asked to play that character, the player king. But when he asked me, I said yes, because I knew that there was a specific English actor, mostly unknown to most people, who I was going to emulate. I was going to play him in my mind. And I told that to the author and director, and he said, go ahead, knock yourself out. And so it was like being on a magic carpet, because I wasn't me. I was this other guy, but no one's going to know that because this other guy was so different than me, you never would have picked him. But if I happened to chance upon Guildenstern on television, I will watch my scenes. Because I look at it like, you pulled that off, you son of a gun, you. And there's a bunch of them like that. Let It Ride was one of the happiest experiences of my life, not least of which was because I didn't have to change my clothes. I got to wear one thing the entire movie.
Is there a project coming up that you feel could put you in the zone? Is there something coming up in your life that you are passionate about and excited about?
Actually, the only thing I'm that excited about is I'm writing a book about the damage that the absence of civics is causing in the country.
Yes.
And I'm writing a book about that.
I wanted to ask you about the Dreyfus Civics Initiative. I know we're running out of time, but let me end then on a personal note, because civics... the teaching of civics in school is something that you're very passionate about. When did that passion take root, and why is that important to you?
Well, when I look back on my life, I realize it's always been the most important political issue. I was raised by not only a political family who were intensely proud of being Americans, but I was raised by Walt Disney, and Walt Disney every week taught me to love my country. And sometime around the 1990s, I became aware of something different in the atmosphere of the country, but I couldn't name it. And at the time that I first spoke about it, it went nameless. And I said to this audience of, I think it's called the American Magazine Editors Conference. I was slotted in between General Powell and General Weisskopf. Oh. So if anyone ever asks you, is it a good thing to be a movie star? The answer is, you betcha.
Yes.
But I said to this audience in 1991, something has happened in America which I have no name for, but which is without a doubt the worst possible thing that could ever happen. And maybe by talking about it, we could figure out what it is. And amongst the other things I said was, didn't we just win something? Didn't we have some kind of a cold something or other, hostile, mm-hmm. and it was a nuclear something or other, and it was duck and cover, and
yes.
all of a sudden they're gone, and we're alone on the mountaintop. I said, where are the parades?
Yes.
Where are the parades of this victory which has lived with us since I was born? I said, unless there are parades, I have to entertain the idea that maybe the whole thing was a scam. And that was 1991. By the year 2000, I knew what it was. And so no one takes me very seriously when I say this, but I retired in 2003 or 4. I had knocked off a bunch of things on my little bucket list, and I knew that I only had one life. So I retired, and I went to school in England for 4 years. And I studied the damage that was being done to my country by the absence of the teaching of civics and civic authority, which was vast. And when I came home, I started to talk about it, and I had talked to 200,000 people ultimately, and I didn't make a dent.
Yeah.
And so at a certain point, I decided I'm going to have to write this as a book. And I'm not a writer, and I'm not comfortable writing, and but I still have to do this, and it's hopefully will be finished soon. And it's, I believe there's a reason. You can take any problem we have now, whether it's political or social, and you can bring it right back to the absence of learning civic authority, civility, civic discourse. If you are not taught how to exercise the sovereign power of the people, then you don't got it.
Yeah.
And if you don't got it, you ain't going to exercise it. If no one teaches the difference between yelling, screaming, and interrupting, and civility, you're not going to discover civility by yourself.
Yes.
You're not going to come upon it and understand what it is or what its advantage is. And that's why we have come so unstrung, and how hate has become an acceptable emotional intercourse between sectors of the country, when that was as emotional as our politics have always been. Hate only happened once, and that was with the Civil War. That was hate.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost us 700,000 dead men to even begin to improve that situation, and we didn't do anything to improve it, so it's the same as it was then. But we have to teach all of our kids, and if we don't, that means we're not connected to our kids, which means that we're not connected to the America of the future. And the preamble to the Constitution says, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and ensure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain this Constitution. And if that isn't a connection to our future, I don't know what is. And we do not teach civics, and have not in 40 years.
I couldn't agree more, and this is something you're obviously very passionate about, and I think it goes beyond political affiliation. I think it speaks to the value of education.
Absolutely.
And not just civics, but history and art and everything that is not just math and science. Math and science are important, but that's not where it ends. So, yeah.
And math and science can't be taught well unless you're connected to history and the future.
Absolutely. This is a perfect way to wrap it up, Richard.
I appreciate very much you calling.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to my guest, Richard Dreyfuss, and thanks to you for listening. For more information on the Florida Film Festival, please visit floridafilmfestival.com, orlandoweekly.com, and meyermovies.com. I'll see you at the Florida Film Festival.